From suspending himself by hooks in the 1970s to wiring his muscles to the internet in the 1990s and surgically constructing and cell growing an ear on his arm, our guest on The Year That Made Me has spent a lifetime and literally made an art of re-engineering the human body. He says the body is obsolete. He's an Australian artist with a genuinely global footprint, performing from Tokyo to New York and Venice, holding research posts in the UK and the US, and picking up major honours along the way. A monograph published by MIT once called Stelarc the most celebrated artist in the world working with technology and the visual arts. Yet, to some extent in Australia, he's a bit of a best-kept secret. Stelarc, welcome to The Year That Made Me.
Thanks, Julian.
Could you tell us the big outline of your life story? Where were you born and how did you come to Australia?
Born in Cyprus, in Limassol, and my parents emigrated after the Second World War, so I was only like four or five when I arrived in Australia.
And what was your life like as a young new arrival in Australia?
Oh, I really don't remember too much. I mean, had a pretty conventional upbringing. My parents, of course, were immigrants, not highly educated, but I ended up going to art school and uni. I did my education here in Australia, but, you know, a couple of years after I finished that, I decided I should experience an Oriental culture. And because Japan was also high tech, I decided to go to Japan in 1970.
And that's the year that you've chosen as the year that made you, Stelarc. Before we get to that, though, I wonder, what was the prospect of a career in art received like in your family? Is there a family tradition of suspending yourself by hooks in public?
No, I mean, my parents, I never really confided with my parents about my arts practice. I mean, they had no training in higher education, so even discussing art in general was difficult. And yeah, my parents would have expected me to do architecture instead of go into the visual arts. So
yeah. So where did your interest in the visual arts begin and how did it evolve to the point that you took it on as a serious practice?
Oh, I always imagined as a kid growing up that I wanted to be an artist. But of course, that was a very naive idea because, you know, being an artist at that time, at that young age, meant being able to draw well, be able to paint, and so on. And then when I hit art school, I discovered I wasn't particularly good compared to everyone else. And because I found I was such a bad painter, I decided perhaps I should do performance instead. I mean, that's the trivial but true response. On the other hand, I'd always been interested in the kind of evolutionary architecture of the human body, the biological parameters of our physiology and our sensory systems that enable us to perceive and operate and interact in the world. And so the idea of going into performance, of using your own body as the means of expression, that was, I guess, the more fundamental reason.
So when did you first do that, Stelarc, and what did you do the first time?
Well, even at art school, I was supposedly majoring in sculpture, but I really didn't like molding, carving, casting, or welding. I did things like I made helmets that altered your binocular perception, an immersive 3 meter high, 3 meter diameter compartment that optically altered your vision and also immersed you with electronic music. And because I wasn't fulfilling course requirements, RMIT decided I shouldn't go on after my third year. So, you know, kind of being kicked out of art school was a fairly traumatic moment given the fact that I always wanted to be an artist. But it was sort of at that time that I decided I should go elsewhere and naively be a full-time artist in Japan.
Yes, that's a big move. Many people would not react to being thrown out of art school in Australia that way. So you've chosen 1970 as the year that made you Stellark, and Japan clearly was fundamental to that. Why did you go to Japan and what did you do there?
Yeah, well, Japan, because it was an interesting culture to me, and also because it was so high tech, they were the two reasons for initially going. And as I said, naively, because I didn't speak any Japanese, I didn't try to learn Japanese before I went. I just decided I should go and naively thought I could manage. But when I arrived, it was a rather traumatic moment in Japan because Yukio Mishima committed seppuku. You know, I'd known of him only as a novelist, but didn't realize his right-wing politics. And seeing all of the newspaper coverage of his suicide certainly made an impact on arriving in Japan. Soon after arrival, I should add.
And you've described the year as comprising not just one shock that you've just spoken about, but three shocks. What else shocked you in 1970 in Japan, Stella?
Of course, the culture was so different to what I'd been used to. Of course, you know, in a Greek family in Melbourne, but everything was strange. But I guess the things that really made impact on me initially, because of my interest in the human body, was in this order: sumo wrestling, buto dance, and Japanese humanoid robotics.
Tell us about buto dance.
Well, it was certainly something that I hadn't known or seen any performances of previously. A very, very different kind of dance form. It began post-war in Japan, and the feeling was that the Japanese physique wasn't suitable to traditional and contemporary Western dance. Buto is much more kind of grounded with micro movements, incredible balance, often very slow moving. And to me, it appeared almost like a post nuclear catastrophic body. You know, buto dancers typically at that time were completely clean shaven, painted white. So there was an erasing of individuality and even an erasing of gender, because sometimes you couldn't tell the difference between the male and female dancers. But movements that to me were kind of anything from zombie-like to insect and animal-like movements. That was like the first impressions I had of buto dance. But of course, befriending some buto dancers, especially Tanaka Min, or Min Tanaka, who's now become the foremost buto dancer in Japan and internationally known. I learned a little bit more about the background philosophy and became really enamored with that particular type of performance. But also with sumo wrestling, buto dance, and humanoid robots, you know, it sort of readjusted my idea of what a body is and how a body performs and the kinds of materiality of the body, the alternative embodiments that one sort of witnessed in Japan. And of course, that mixed with the traditional culture, the sort of collaborative approach to making decisions, for example, in Japan, rather than the sort of individual Western ego-oriented approach to decision-making. All of those things were really impactful and adjusted my up to then very Western and individualistic behaviour.
And Stelak, were you creating your own artworks as you were sort of orientating yourself to this whole new way of living and this new country in 1970?
Yeah. In terms of my performance work, the performance projects from then up till now don't progress in a kind of linear, predictable fashion. You could say that it's more of an oscillation between the biological, the technological, the virtual. But at that time, and the first meaningful action I did in Japan was to make three films of the inside of my body. Not for any medical reason, but as an artistic gesture, you know, the idea of probing the sort of internal tracks of the body, you know. And up until then, my experience of my body and other bodies was at surface level, at skin level. And all of a sudden, I was imaging empty spaces inside the body, circulatory systems, soft tissue, the inside of organs, the inside of the stomach, the inside of the lungs. And so this was a really significant moment. And for example, 20 years later, for the fifth Australian sculpture triennale, that was the influence that made me think of engineering a sculpture for the inside of my stomach. The theme of the 1993 Biennale of Sculpture was site-specific works. But instead of a sculpture for a public space, I decided to design a sculpture for a private internal space, a sculpture for a soft organ of the body. So the body itself becomes the host of its own artwork. And it actually turned into a simple machine choreography inside the stomach, because the stomach sculpture opens and closes, extends and retracts, has a flashing light and a beeping sound. So you have to imagine this as a simple machine choreography inside the human body.
Yes, it's fair to say that discussing any art on the radio can be challenging, but your works in particular are probably hard to describe and well worth Googling to get a sense of the extraordinary range of work that you've done over a number of decades, Stelak. So you were creating art in 1970 and it was your intention to become a full-time artist. Were you able to actually make a living out of your art at that time?
No.
So what did you do? How'd you get by?
I quickly realized that my money was running out, and to remain in Japan, I needed to find a job. You know, at that time, you couldn't remain in Japan. You couldn't get a Japanese visa. Cultural visa runs out after 3 months. But a Japanese friend alerted me that there was an advertisement for an art teacher. I applied for that job and fortuitously I got it. I think I was the only one to apply. And the teaching was in English, so that made it a simple transition. From that point on, I was able to do a series of performances. Also, when I arrived in Japan, the realization was that there was no real performance art happening there anymore. The Gutai, a group that was active in the 50s, 60s, their activities had subsided by the early 70s. And also at that time, the genre of art being practiced was a kind of an installation-based art using Japanese paper, rocks, wood. And also there was no high-tech art happening in Japan at the time. In fact, my Japanese artist friends would remind me, high tech, low art. But because of the interest in the body and technology in general, the medical projects probing the human body, and also doing a series of performances where you explored the physical and psychological limits of the body, sensory deprivation types of performances. In fact, the first performance before the suspension events began was in a gallery where I was tethered to the gallery wall with two hooks into my back, connecting with cable, two hooks into the wall. And I stitched my lips and eyelids shut with surgical needle and thread. This was in 1974. I intended to stay for 5 days, but I only lasted 3 days. In that time, I couldn't speak, I couldn't see, I couldn't eat, I couldn't drink, I could hear. So those kinds of sensory deprivation performances preceded the first suspension event, which was supposed to happen in Adelaide at the Experimental Art Foundation in 1975, and it was cancelled. It caused an uproar in the art world because it was supposedly at the Experimental Arts Foundation, but the media got a hold of what was going to happen, that I was going to suspend my body with hooks into the skin. The police got into the action because at that time in Adelaide, South Australia, it was effectively a crime to self-inflict injury. And the performance was stopped. The Experimental Art Foundation withdrew their support. And so I decided, well, okay, when I do this, I'll do this in Japan in complete privacy, no audience invited. And a lot of the suspension performances happened in private gallery spaces without an audience or in remote locations.
Yeah, so throughout the 1970s, you were doing what are described as levitation and suspension performances, and they do look amazing, but also I imagine, Stella, like, are they incredibly painful to be suspended through hooks in your skin for periods of time?
Well, they certainly were physically challenging. And I decided at the time that if I did them, I would not use any kind of medication or anesthetic. I guess you could describe different levels of difficulty in doing a suspension performance. The initial insertion of one hook into your skin, then there are 17 more. So you're lying there. You needed the assistance of a couple of people, one to pinch the skin away from muscle and the other person to actually insert the hook. Then the next level of difficulty was when the hooks had tension on them when you connected the cables. And then when finally your body lifts up off the ground or off the structure you're supported on, the full weight of the body stretches the skin. The skin becomes a kind of gravitational landscape of what it means to be suspended in a 1G gravitational field. So they were the three kind of levels of difficulty really that increasingly intensified as the suspension unfolded.
Do you think you have an unusually high pain tolerance?
No, I don't think so, as witnessed by the fact that every time I go to the dentist, I'm a coward.
How long were these performances?
Well, the times varied from anywhere between 15 minutes to an hour, but time was never a consideration. It was more the process and what the circumstances allowed. So, for example, when my body was counterbalanced by a ring of rocks in the Maki Gallery in Tokyo, I decided to end the performance when the telephone rang in the gallery, which kind of ended the sort of meditative moment. On the other hand, in New York, when I was suspended over East 11th Street, which was meant to be at least a 30-minute performance, ended after 11 minutes when the police arrived, broke in and ended the performance and arrested me. So that performance was shorter than anticipated. So, you know, circumstances varied, determining the length of the suspension performances.
It's interesting you used the word meditative. Could you give us a sense of what you are thinking about or the state that you are in when you were doing these levitation and suspension performances?
I only use the word meditative because that was the best way to describe it to you. But the best way that I would describe my state preceding and during a performance is that I'm the same before, I'm still the same during the performance, and I'm quickly the same afterwards. The performances are done with what I would describe as a posture of indifference. You know, you allow the performance to unfold in its own time with its own rhythm. There's no transcendental intent in these experiences. The body is seen as a sculptural object in relationship to other objects and other people and other circumstances. So there's no sort of yogic control, shamanistic expression or prowess exhibited. It's just a body suspended in varying positions in different situations in remote locations and sometimes in urban environments.
On The Year That Made Me, we're speaking with performance artist Stellark and the year of 1970 in Japan, which led to a period of working in levitation and suspension. After that, Stellark, you also experimented in robotics. Could you tell us about the work Third Hand?
Yeah, I mean, it has to be remembered that this wasn't after the suspensions. Mm. In fact, the Third Hand project began the same year as the first suspension event. As I said, there was an oscillation of concern between the physical, the technological, and the virtual. In the case of the Third Hand, having done these sensory and physically stressful projects and performances, there was a kind of a desire to augment the body, discovering the limitations of the body and realizing with the early suspensions that the body was totally inadequate. In fact, the realization was that the body was fundamentally obsolete in function and in form. So this desire to augment the body comes about through those early performances. The Third Hand was the first augmentation. The Third Hand has a pinch release, a grasp release, a 300-degree wrist rotation, clockwise and counterclockwise. It has a rudimentary sense of touch, and it was sophisticated enough at the time in 1980 to get invitations from the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena and the Johnson Space Center in Houston to demonstrate the hand to the extravehicular activity group. But having said that, the hand was really an artistic project, an aesthetic attachment for performance, but it was state of the art at the time. Having augmented the body with technology, using stainless steel, aluminium, electronic circuitry, there was in 1996, when I was doing a residency at Carnegie Mellon University, at what was known then as the Studio for Creative Inquiry, which encouraged interdisciplinarity, I grew rat myoblasts in the biology lab there. You know, and that sort of generated an interest in wet media. And also the idea that perhaps what would be interesting would be to create a soft prosthesis that would not be simplistically attached to my body, but would become a part of my body, a living part of my body. So the Eironome project begins as an idea in 1996, but it took 10 years of consulting and trying to get surgical assistance before three plastic surgeons were found and funding was made possible to begin the first surgical procedures in 2006. It was an idea that was really difficult to realize. I mean, consulting with surgeons, they were very helpful in alerting me about some of the problems, but no one would agree to actually do it. Partly because the original project was imaged as an ear on the side of my head. You know, sort of normal on one side, but if I turn my head, there would be an extra ear on the other side. But this was not a very easy project to convince people to do. And after 10 years, the alternative was, well, these surgeons would construct an ear on my arm.
And how long did you have that for?
Oh, I still have it. I mean, it's a living part of my body. You know, after the scaffold is inserted beneath the skin, after the skin is suctioned over the scaffold, which is a biopolymer scaffold, you have tissue ingrowth and vascularization occurring. So the ear becomes integrated, or the ear scaffold, should I say, becomes integrated and a living part of your body.
It's an extraordinary range of work that you've undertaken. And obviously your canvas, your body must have changed a lot over the years of your practice. How would you describe your relationship with your body today compared to when you started out?
Oh, I guess a little bit more self-aware of its increasing malfunctioning and increasingly physiological parameters. But up until now, I've been able to achieve everything that I've wanted to do in my performances. I mean, in 2018, for example, I did a performance titled Rewired Remixed, which was a durational performance. So for 5 days, 6 hours every day, continuously, I could only see with the eyes of someone in London. I could only hear with the ears of someone in New York, but anyone anywhere at any time could access my right arm via the exoskeleton I was wearing and remotely activate the movements of the arm. The durational performances I can certainly still manage, but yes, there may be physical limitations because next year I'll be 80. And in fact, next year is the 50th anniversary of my first suspension performance.
Is there a particular way you'd like to be remembered as an artist, Stella?
Well, hopefully for my latter works. For my not yet completed artworks, for my future performances. Oh, look, I think, you know, as artists, I think what artists do best, in fact, they generate contingent and contestable possibilities, ones that can be performed, can be personally experienced, can be interrogated, evaluated, perhaps meaningfully articulated, possibly appropriated, most likely discarded. So we have to remember that, you know, a future is not a future of necessity. In fact, a future is not a future if it's not unpredictable. So how an artist's work is evaluated is left to a later time by others, not by the artist.
Well, of course, we wish you many, many more successful and adventurous years of artistic practice. But I did wonder, and I hope you don't mind me asking, Stella, given that your body has been an integral part of your artworks, do you have a particular intention artistic or personal for your body when you no longer are alive?
It's a question that's increasingly being asked. I don't know why. But it must be noted that we're in an age now where for the first time there's proximal existence with other kinds of bodies, such as plastinated bodies, which can be preserved forever, with cryogenically preserved bodies, which await reanimation at some imagined future, with comatose bodies that are sustained on technological life support systems, with yet-to-be-born bodies, with frozen embryos, with artificial life, synthetic life, prosthetically augmented bodies. So there are all of these possibilities of maintaining or perhaps even indefinitely preserving your body. To be honest, I haven't really thought of any of those possibilities. And I mean, the only reason I would do something like that, in some way preserving the body, creating that final artwork, whether in a physically preserved way through plastination, whether in an avatar way with uploaded data, or in a humanoid robotic form, the only way I would do that would be to create another artwork.
And on that intriguing note, we will say thank you very much, Stelarc. Thank you so much for joining us on The Year That Made Me.
Thanks.
And we always finish this segment by going out with a piece of music chosen by our guest, Stelarc. What have you chosen for us and why?
Well, actually, recently I've gotten to know a punk rock group out of Melbourne that has sort of gained international recognition, Amel and the Sniffers.
Yes.
The song, You Should Not Be Doing That, might be a really upbeat way of ending the program.
An appropriate Stelarc anthem. Here's Amel and the Sniffers, You Should Not Be Doing That. And Stelarc, thank you once again.
Yeah, thanks, Julian.